when you're in a public place and someone is doing something irritating, like they're talking behind you in the movie, do you say something? And some people will be like, definitely not. I'll just be really, really mad and fume, but I'm not the kind of person who causes a problem. And then other people will say, oh, I absolutely would say something because I would want someone to say something to me. And I'm the kind of person who's very direct.
That's Sheila Heen, founder of Triad Consulting, professor at Harvard Law School, and the New York Times bestselling author of Difficult Conversations, How to Discuss What Matters Most.
And the only difference between those two is the story we're telling about who we are in doing what we're doing.
I'm Michael Mogul, founder and CEO of Crisp, the nation's number one law firm growth company. I've built my business through practice, not theory. Crisp started with just $500 to my name and has grown to over eight figures in revenue over the last few years, earning a spot on the Inc. 500 list of the fastest growing private companies in America. Our approach has been to take everything we've learned about generating massive growth within our own organization and help the country's most ambitious and committed law firm owners do the same for theirs. In each episode of this podcast, I sit down with innovative market leaders from the legal industry and beyond to learn from those who thrive in the face of adversity, challenge the status quo, and define what it means to be a true game changer. I sat down with Sheila Heen to discuss how to raise tough issues and have productive conversations, how our feelings influence our thinking, and the different types of feedback leaders can give and what actually works.
We actually need all three kinds of feedback to learn and grow, but they have really different purposes. We're not very disciplined about thinking about what kind of feedback do I need right now and how could I get it? Or what kind of feedback am I offering and is that what they need?
That's coming up on the Game Changing Attorney podcast. Before we begin today's episode, I want to remind you that we aren't beholden to any sponsors or run any ads on this podcast. This allows us to present all of our episodes raw and unfiltered. I'm not going to push any made-to-order meal services on you or try to save you any money on your car insurance. That being said, I have one small request. If you receive any value from this podcast, please give it a five-star review. Pay the fee so we can keep this podcast free. All right, Sheila, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here.
I'm excited to have you here. Obviously, having read both of your books and I've heard you on several other podcasts, I want to get to some of the books. But before we do that, if you could speak to perhaps some of the early experiences that, I don't know, perhaps shaped you into who you are today. I know that's a bit of a loaded question, but I heard you grew up in the Midwest and just curious how that, you know, that journey looked like to get to where you are today.
Yeah. So one of the things that I think is most interesting about where I have ended up is that I don't think I could have really imagined it. People ask you as a kid all the time, what do you want to be when you grow up? Which is, of course, the most ridiculous question in the world. I don't think that I had answers for that. But what I had was direction, maybe. And at some point, I decided, I felt this was extremely insightful at the time. I decided that whatever I was going to do, I was going to try to be the best in the world at it. And somehow that felt like an actual answer to me that made me feel relaxed. So, yes, I grew up in Iowa and then Nebraska. I ended up heading to California for college. I went to Occidental College. And then I came to Harvard for law school, not because I knew law was the right place for me, but because I thought, well, I don't know what else I'm going to do. So this will give me both a credential that will help with a lot of things and just a discipline in thinking that probably will be helpful. And then I did have a college advisor who said, you know, Harvard has this negotiation thing and I have a feeling it might be your deal, which, of course, I am forever grateful to him for. He was right on the money.
So I'm curious, one of the things you mentioned that you said that no matter what you did, you wanted to be the best in the world at it. Now, as a father of two young daughters, what led to that drive, or you know, was there someone in your own life that influenced you? Was that just something that came naturally to you? Why did you want to be the best in the world?
I think that I felt like it was a destination at which to arrive somehow, and I felt like the questions I was getting about what I wanted to be suggested there was a destination. So it was the only destination I really knew how to define. You know, one of the things that I say, I do part of orientation for the first year law students who arrive at Harvard Law School. And one of the things I say to them is that in my experience, people end up in law school for one of two reasons. Reason number one is that you or your family has had experience with the law. Situations where the law stood up for you in an important way, or situations where the law let you down. And you're here in some ways in response to that because you want to learn the language of the law and be able to change the world or change your community's experience, whatever that might be. Reason number two that people come to law school, I don't know, didn't know what else I was going to do. And so I think some people have a sense of like, this is my path. And I'm not sure I had a sense of the path, but I did have a sense that I wanted to go as far as I could on that path. I've since, of course, discovered, as you have, I'm sure, that there is no destination,
right?
And I think that's been slower in coming. And I think that's what I've tried to instill in my kids, which is there's no destination, but at least enjoy it along the way and show up as the best version of yourself that you can. And that will generally serve you well.
Yeah, the other thing you mentioned is once you got to Harvard Law, you took the class on negotiation. And I know since you've joined the Harvard Negotiation Project, what drew you to that field in particular?
I think that in the particularly sitting alongside the doctrinal classes, and I found my first year of law school fun, partly fun because it was such a communal experience, right? We're all going through it together. We have so much in common to talk about after class about what happened in class and what the heck is going on. And does anybody understand what is going on? But the sitting alongside the doctrinal classes was this one elective that I got to opt into that was all about human beings and what makes them tick and what influences them and why we think what we think and why we care about what we care about and what gets in the way of changing our minds or how it is that we make up our minds. And that was fascinating to me. That I felt like, gee whiz, I could learn something new for the rest of my life. And it's relevant to everything that we do in our personal, individual lives, but also in the profession and on the planet.
I'm curious through that experience, how long have you been a part of the Harvard Negotiation Project? I mean, it's probably been 20 plus years, right?
It's been a minute. Yeah, I just had my 30-year reunion. Yeah.
Wow.
It's good that we got that on tape.
Yeah. So how has, just the field of negotiation evolved? Just seeing it over those years, like what have been the biggest shifts?
Yeah. Well, so it has just grown and flourished in the last 30, 40 years, as I'm sure many of your listeners are aware of. And when students come to me and say, gosh, I don't know what I want to do with this law degree, where I want to go, I'm really interested in the field of negotiation and ADR. And my follow-up question is always, well, there isn't a field. The good news is everybody in the world needs these skills. And then the question is, where is the playing field that calls your name in terms of where you want to play? So there's like international negotiation, international relief, health issues, et cetera, and negotiation, of course, and mediation and international arbitration. So then there's a whole field of arbitration, domestic and international. There's the whole realm of mediation, court annexed mediation, family, commercial, et cetera. But also every organization in the world needs people who can help others understand problems and find solutions together and to collaborate more effectively. And then there's the world of teaching and writing and trying to better understand what gets in the way of doing that. I mean, we could go on and on, right? But it's like, which way do you lean? Because there's a whole world out there. And the problem often for those of us who come to law school is that it feels like a very linear path sometimes. And many of us are very good at hitting those marks on a linear path to mark progress. And coming out, the easiest place to go is big law. And then there are markers for whether you're succeeding and whether you eventually make partner. And it feels like a linear destination. Life and ADR, the field of negotiation and dispute resolution, are not linear at all. So you have to have a lot of tolerance for uncertainty, ambiguity, and for charting a path that's right for you. And that's not a throwaway line because it's not easy to do, as I'm sure you know, right? It's part of what your podcast is all about. I'm curious what you've noticed about people trying to find that path for themselves.
Yeah. So, I mean, as it relates to negotiation, I think what I've seen, a perspective has shifted largely from winning to seeking to understand. I guess that's what I see. And a lot of times when people have these conversations before, it was like, I'm such a great negotiator, I'm going to pummel the other side, right? It was like this aggressive play versus now it's like, well, how do we reach a common ground?
Yeah. And how do we solve the right problems, right? Because my sense of what the problem is or what we're trying to achieve may be different than yours. If we understand that, there may be something bigger, right, that we can do or salvage. One of the things I've been reminded of recently by my co-author, Bruce Patton, is that while people talk about and misuse the idea of win-win negotiation a lot, it's definitely true that there is also lose-lose. And there are ways that we can waste each other's time, resources, create more stress, et cetera. And I think that too often we overlook that what we're trying to do is actually also help us sidestep lose-lose.
Right, right. And by the way, we promised we were going to talk politics, right? Speaking of lose-lose. I know you mentioned your co-authors. So Doug and Bruce with Difficult Conversation, the infamous book, phenomenal book. Now, this is another one that I think came out over 20 years ago. And I saw that it was updated a few times. There's been new editions. I think even recently, I think the newest edition just launched about a year ago. What typically changes from edition to edition? And how do you go, you know, decide about what's going to be revised?
Yeah, great question. So you're right. It was originally published in 1999. First of all, you're going to learn we can't count. So we did a 10th anniversary edition, quote unquote, which launched in 2010, 11 years later. We didn't really touch the text other than just to clean up a few things that we had found that were typos or unclear. Instead, for the second edition, we added about 60 new pages called 10 Questions People Ask, which were the kinds of questions that we got regularly in that 10 or 11 year period. The third edition, which came out last August, was actually a much bigger project because we basically took the whole book apart. And it wasn't so much that we changed the fundamental framework, but we did rewrite a lot of the examples. We rewrote a couple of the chapters because looking at them again, it was like, gosh, the main points that we're making are not the main points that I find myself using the most. And also some of the things that we have said, particularly around intentions and impact, and those being of equal importance, were sometimes being misunderstood. So we clearly were not being clear enough, for instance. And then we rewrote many of the questions at the back, including we spent about 6 months working on the two questions about power and the role of power in negotiation. What if the other side has more power? And well, what if I'm in charge? Can't I just tell people what to do? Because our own understanding of the role of power has been very much evolving over time and feels very important, right, as a piece to connect to. You know, we also rewrote the section on like, well, what about all the different channels of communication that we have? Email, text, Slack, Zoom, video call, whatever it would be. How do I choose a channel and what are the upsides and downsides? And just observing that email or text or Slack, all of those are not really dialogue. They're really serial monologue. So there are some upsides sometimes, but they also are places where conflict can escalate the most quickly.
It's like the core insights remain the same, right? But if somebody were reading the same book from, you know, the 1999 edition today, some of the examples, it's just fascinating to me, right? It kind of touches on the nature of even difficult conversations of like how perspectives can shift and how someone can interpret something differently today than, you know, than perhaps a few decades ago. So, I mean, it seems like these types of updates are bringing it up to what the times are today. Do you kind of look ahead and say, okay, 30 years from now, are you going to be updating this thing again?
Yeah, we do, actually. And I mean, we try to make the examples pretty universal and pretty varied from the beginning. So we don't tend to use current events because they're almost immediately not current. We are trying to create something that is a stable place to stand in a world that's changing quickly in terms of just understanding the mess and the challenge and having some landmarks to navigate a conversation more successfully, whether that's inside your family or inside your community or at work. I think part of our impetus for the third edition was that it was probably somewhat overdue, but also that I think we try to continue to learn. And if we're not updating our own learning, then why are we doing it? And so we were kind of overdue for that.
Now, in the book, I know you state that communication is key to getting what you want, but some conversations are harder to have than others. How do you define a difficult conversation? Like, what makes a conversation more difficult, you know, or less difficult?
Oh, gosh, what doesn't make a conversation difficult? I mean, I'll be curious about your answer, by the way, about what makes conversations difficult for you. For me, sometimes it's that there's a lot of uncertainty involved. So I feel like we don't have great information. We're trying to make a judgment call. And maybe we have very different information. And so we have different instincts about the way to go. It could be that there's a lot of history in the relationship, right? So this is just the latest example of each of us feeling frustrated or badly treated by the other. And we're bringing all of that that we're carrying in the door with us. Sometimes it's that I don't know what I want or what I think, right? So some of the hardest conversations are the conversations I have with myself about trade-offs and where I feel like, okay, I have to make a hard decision. What can I live with? And how does that intersect with identity and the story I tell about the person I want to be? Because those are often in conflict. I think we can be really simplistic about identity. And some of the hardest conversations are places where your own identity is in conflict. Like, I want to be a good parent. I also want to be responsive to clients. I'm now with my kid and my phone is ringing. Do I take the call? That's a simple moment where my identities are in conflict with each other. And often difficult conversations for me are places where, gosh, I could tell two stories about who I want to be and they each take me in a slightly different direction. What about for you? What's hard for you?
So I've been thinking about this. It's probably a couple things. One is, it is being very clear on what I want, right? Sometimes I ask myself before I go into a room, you know, and have the type of conversation is, you know, am I bringing my frustrations with me? And how relevant is this to what we're going to be discussing? Is it to vent or is it to drive, you know, behavioral change? And then I think the other challenge is if, you know, speaking in front of a room of people, for example, how does that message land uniquely with each person, right? So there might be things that resonate more strongly with some than others. And when you have different interpretations and different personality styles and so on, like, how do you make sure that that message is landing? So I think those are probably the two biggest challenges.
Yeah, and you're reminding me that it's true that often in leadership, right, you've got people lobbying for one direction or another, and you're going to disappoint someone or frustrate someone who very genuinely believes that you are wrong and nuts for this decision.
Always.
And maybe a bad person also, just to throw in an extra
little
juicy bit.
It's interesting. We did a podcast on this. It's like it's the nature of leadership, right? It's that you're trying to make decisions that aren't always going to be 100% popular with everybody or agreeable to everyone, but you're ultimately trying to do what you believe is best for the organization. And there's obviously going to be different schools of thought on that. Now, I know you mentioned that the identity conversation is one. The other two was like the blame and the feelings. And I feel like a lot of entrepreneurs experience the blame or the what happened conversation. Experience
that
often.
Yeah. Oh, totally. So the basic idea for anybody not familiar with the book is that all difficult conversations really have the same underlying structure. And that if you look at people's internal voices, the things that we're wrestling with, thinking about, feeling, trying to decide what to do about in these messy conversations, you can really bucket them into three conversations that we're having with ourselves and with each other. And the first is what you just named, which is the what happened conversation. And this is our story about what has happened, what we think is happening now, and what we think should happen. And that actually itself, that story has three pieces. One is, what is this really about and what am I right about? Which is the place we feel like what I feel certain I'm right about is a place I'm tempted to cling because it feels the safest. But it's actually a trap because then I'm not curious about what I might be missing. The second part of that story about what happened is blame. Whose fault is it that we're having this problem? And the third is all about intentions and motivations. Why are they acting this way? Why are they being so stupid or annoying or irresponsible? But sitting underneath that story that we have about what happened is what we call the feelings conversation, which is how we each feel treated by the other. And we're each trying to figure out how to manage our own feelings or respond to the other person's feelings if they yell or cry or are bitterly disappointed in us. And finally, the last piece is that sitting under all of that, at the heart of it, is the identity conversation, which is the story we tell about who we are or want to be. And often, if a conversation feels difficult, it's because something around identity has gotten hooked. And that generates bigger feelings and anxiety than normal. And then that colors the story we're telling about what happened. So they're all linked together.
It's like you consider yourself a nice person, right? Until you have to do something confrontational. Oh,
totally. I mean, a really easy way to hone in on this is like when you're in a public place and someone is doing something irritating, like they're talking behind you in the movie, do you say something? And some people will be like, definitely not. I'll just be really, really mad and fume. But I'm not the kind of person who causes a problem or is annoying, or is it, unfortunately, what is referred to these days as a Karen. Totally unfair to all the Karens in the world who have their own identity issues that we're foisting upon them. And then other people will say, oh, I absolutely would say something because I would want someone to say something to me. And I'm the kind of person who's very direct, right? And forthright. And I'm just being thoughtful. And the only difference between those two is the story we're telling about who we are in doing what we're doing and making the choice that we made.
That's fascinating. So because I was going to ask you, like, why are certain types of let's say, difficult conversations easier for some than others? And as you said, it's a difference in the story we're telling ourselves. How does that evolve? Does somebody who once struggles with what they perceive as difficult conversations, do they evolve that story for themselves and now it becomes a little bit easier for them? Is that how that change happens?
Yeah, I do think that's part of it. I think that we're really prone to holding our identity as either or. Either I'm a good person or a bad person. Either I'm competent or I'm totally incompetent. Either I'm thoughtful or careless. And because often there's something the situation suggests about you that feels upsetting, we can fall into that trap pretty quickly. So part of grounding yourself is accepting what might be true about you, which is that you were not as careful or thoughtful as you might have been in this situation. You have contributed to the problem in some way. And also to see yourself as not either or, right? You're a thoughtful person who, like all humans, occasionally overlooks something, right? Or forgets to reach out or consult with someone, and then they feel overlooked. So I think holding your identity as someone who tries to be X and occasionally falls short, and that being normal, it's very aligned with Carol Dweck's work on moving from a fixed identity or a fixed mindset to a growth mindset. And I used to think, I mean, this is actually kind of funny. I used to see a growth mindset or a fixed mindset as either or. You were either a fixed mindset person or a growth mindset person. And just like identity not being either or, I have learned through experience that I'm always fluctuating between the two. And I'm apt to hear it feedback to me as, you know, verdict about who I am and whether I'm a good enough person. It's not imprint, it's input. And I can negotiate myself into a growth mindset and hear it differently as useful input on something I should maybe pay more attention to, or an apology that I owe someone, that I need to be the kind of person who's willing to do that and to own my mistakes and apologize for them. And so that's the negotiation with myself that is actually negotiating with my own identity and into a growth place.
Yeah. By nature or by definition, that difficult conversations can be uncomfortable to initiate. It seems like a good rule of thumb, as we've discussed, is never to start with your own story, but to approach it. I know you mentioned a few times, like turning to a third story. What do you mean by that?
Yeah. So anytime you've got two people having an issue that probably warrants discussion, each person has a story. And in my story, I'm the good person. You're the problem, which is obviously true. And so if I start the conversation from my own story, like, can we just talk about the fact that you don't ever clean up the kitchen or, you know, sort the files the way they're supposed to be sorted so that nobody can find the way around the drive? Whatever it would be, you'll catch on pretty quick that in this little play I'm inviting you to join, I am the hero and you are the villain, or at least the idiot. And that's not a play you particularly want to be cast in. In your play, of course, those roles are reversed because you're the person who pays attention to what's really important around here and doesn't get hung up on the kind of anal baloney that I do. And so you're the person who actually has your priorities straight, and I'm the person who is nagging or annoying or whatever. So neither one of those places is a great place from which to invite someone else into a good conversation. And that's what we mean when we say start from the third story is start from the perspective of someone who was a third party who saw what was legitimate and noticed what was different about each of our stories. And I can do that for myself or for the two of us, even when I'm a party, not a mediator. So I might say, you know, I think you and I have different preferences or habits when it comes to the way we're sorting the files or cleaning up the kitchen. And I wonder whether we could talk about it because there might be a better way to handle that difference. Neither one of us is the good person or the bad person. Now I'm treating you as a peer or a partner in just exploring whether there are better options. And that's a more inviting conversation to have.
Is there like a degree of like empathy here?
There's a degree of empathy here. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, part of what's hard about empathy is that when I'm annoyed with you, I don't really care about how you feel about it. And so that is very much a negotiation with yourself, right? To actually wonder, be curious, why is it that they don't see it the way I see it? Because the way I see it seems so obvious and so obviously right.
Have you ever heard the expression like that, you know, that emotions come before our thinking, that you don't pick a side out of thinking, you pick a side out of feeling?
Ooh, I have not heard that before, but it certainly resonates.
I was going to say, what do you think about that? I mean, how much do our feelings and emotions play a role in, you know, in our decision making?
Oh, huge, huge. That's also been an interesting, I guess, area of learning for me, which is I think we sometimes treat rationality and irrationality or thinking and feeling as two different domains and never the twain shall meet. And the trick is just to be objective, right? And stick with business and be task oriented. But as I'm sure you have heard from other folks you've had on the podcast, the research doesn't really bear that out. What the research shows is that how we feel impacts how we think, and also that how we think impacts how we feel. So if I think you're pulled over on the side of the road and blocking the way because, you know, you're driving a Tesla and you're running into the liquor store, I am more upset with you because you're obviously an asshole. So I feel I have a bigger reaction. So that my thinking influences my feelings. But it's also true that my feelings influence my thinking, which is that the more frustrated I am with you, the more likely I am to tell a negative story about you. And over time, particularly if we're in relationship, intentions become characteristics and characteristics become character.
Yeah.
And then you're just not the kind of person that I can even deal with. We have a different feelings reaction, actually, if it's an ambulance by the side of the road, where we tell a different story about what's going on that is causing the inconvenience on us, even though the inconvenience is the same.
Yeah, it's almost like the emotion drives the decision, but then we justify it with the logic, right?
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I think that's right. And also, we treat the logic as if it is objective, which it's not. You know, I think that when I need to have a difficult conversation, and this is what we teach people in class, walking through the three conversations to think about, what do I think the issue is here? To me, what's the problem? And there are usually two or three or four things that I think are the real topic of the conversation that are the problem. And then what data do I have for that? What am I observing that gives me that impression? But then thinking, from their point of view, what would they say the problem is here? And often we're just talking past each other, right? Because we're looking at totally different things. And what questions do I have about where they're getting that impression? Because that's disturbing, maybe interesting. What am I contributing to this problem? What are my intentions and what impact might it have on them? And what impact is this having on me and what are their intentions? Like if I can think through the what happened conversation, by the time I get to thinking about the feelings conversation, my feelings have actually started to shift. Because I'm starting to have a more balanced and complete picture of the whole story. And I don't have all the puzzle pieces, but I can at least see which puzzle pieces maybe are missing. And I walk in with a really different purpose in the conversation, which is just to first understand what's going on. Then I can decide what I think, including what I think I'm right about or what I think the right answer is. But negotiating with myself to suspend that judgment isn't easy, particularly these days.
Right. And actually, on that note, I want to shift gears and talk about the other book. So your book, Thanks for the Feedback, which is really on like how, you know, how we see ourselves. You mentioned that there's really three main types of feedback that actually work, right? Appreciation, coaching, and then evaluation. Why are these the ones that work?
Yeah. So this framework, appreciation, coaching, and evaluation being three very different types of feedback, we didn't actually make that up, right? That comes actually from Roger Fisher and John Richardson and Alan Sharp in their book, Getting It Done. And the idea is that when we actually need all three kinds of feedback to learn and grow, but they have really different purposes. So we need appreciation just because appreciation says, I see you and I get you and you matter and I notice how hard you're working. And when you're short on appreciation in a relationship, a work relationship or a personal relationship, that shortage means that it gets in the way of my willingness to receive coaching, which is the second kind of feedback. Because if the first thing you have to say to me after all this time is what you want me to change, it's like, really? Seriously? After all I've done? Right? For you, by the way. So if there's a shortage of appreciation, it also has an impact on engagement and persistence and all of those things. I do think that feeling underappreciated is kind of synonymous with being married or in a long-term partnership, that each party feels underappreciated for everything that they do for the other person or for the family. And so it's not that we can make that go away, but paying attention to it certainly helps. Coaching is the second kind, and it's anything designed to make you better, more effective, more efficient, more knowledgeable. So it's really the engine for learning and growth as a human and as a professional. And as you get higher in any organization, you have a bigger and bigger impact on everybody, and fewer people are willing to tell you about it. So actually, as you get more senior, you need better skills to invite candid coaching because fewer people are willing to take the risk to offer it to you. The other thing that is complicated about coaching is that coaching bumps into the third type of feedback, which is evaluation. And evaluation rates or ranks you, says whether you're on track or how you're doing against expectations. And performance reviews and grades certainly are evaluation, but we're also evaluating any time. We're like, okay, are we prepared for this pitch, right? Is this document ready to go out or not? We're looking at it and talking about, does it meet our standards, our expectations for polish, professionalism, whatever it would be? So we are evaluating day in and day out. It's easier to evaluate the product than to feel judged as a person. And our reaction to being judged as a person means that often we don't hear it can drown out the coaching that's often embedded in the way someone is suggesting that we might change. So we need all three kinds. It's just that we're not very disciplined about thinking about what kind of feedback do I need right now and how could I get it? Or what kind of feedback am I offering and is that what they need? And let me be clearer, as clear as I can be, about what I think I'm offering and why.
Yeah, I think the example that you give in the book is that if somebody's exhausted and worn down, right, coaching is not nearly as effective, right? Probably shift towards appreciation in that moment.
Totally. Well, and often people will send me pieces of writing, right? Like, hey, I'm working on this book. Could you take a look at this? And I have learned to ask what kind of feedback would be helpful for you at this stage. And it's totally legit to say, I'm pouring my heart and soul into this damn thing. I can't tell whether there's anything worth pursuing here. Like, if there's anything that's working that you appreciate, now would be a good time to tell me about it. Other people are like, I just need help because I don't think that the structure of the table of contents is the right, you know, order in which I tell the story. They actually want coaching. And other people are like, hey, what do you think of this? You think it's ready to send out to an agent? That's an evaluation question. And I've learned to ask because I've certainly bumped into offering the wrong thing.
In my first book, I remember we were 10 or 12 revisions into the first manuscript, and I sent it to a colleague, and he's like, what are you looking for here? Which was a wonderful question to ask in that moment. And what I was really looking for is, what do you like about it, right? Because if at this point you beat up the whole thing, we've just gone through 12 revisions already, and that's the last thing we need at this point.
Yeah, exactly. And if he had offered that, he would have had the best intentions in the world. He's trying to be super helpful to you, and you're like, yeah, this is not helpful. I'm now incredibly depressed, and I'm not going to rewrite the damn thing.
So coming back to feedback, I'm curious, in the book, this is incredibly fascinating to me, where I'm sure somebody's listening to this podcast and they think, you know, they've been giving out feedback to their team members and they say to themselves, well, this person's great at taking feedback and this other person, maybe not so much. How much of this is, you know, nature versus nurture? Because I used to think it was all nurture, but and you talk about the role that our genes play in this.
Yeah, yeah. One of the interesting things in working on the feedback book, we really were working on what is so hard about receiving feedback for all of us, frankly, direct and indirect from the people around us in our lives. And partly we found that in response to anybody's direct or indirect suggestion that we could use some feedback, especially coaching and evaluation, that we have triggered reactions. And one of the triggered reactions is what we call an identity trigger. And part of that is how we're wired, the nature question. And there's some evidence that suggests that in terms of our sensitivity to feedback, how upset we get and how long it takes us to recover, individuals can vary by up to 3,000%. And so you've got people who are very, very sensitive, talking with people who are probably undersensitive, and it's just a disaster waiting to happen. I would say that Doug and I, my co-author on the feedback book, are representative of those two ends of the scale. Doug would describe himself as very sensitive. And when people ask him, how do I know if I'm very sensitive or not? His answer is, if you don't know, then you're not. Because if you're very sensitive, you are well aware of it. Like any suggestion that someone is unhappy with you, even that you read into nothing that they've said, can just send you into a tailspin. And I tend to be more even keel. And people who are more even keel, sometimes that's reinforced by nurture, that like, yeah, I've gotten feedback and I've survived it, and that's a good thing to do. And I can be pretty direct. And the story we tell reinforces that directness is helpful, except when we bump into someone who just is so overwhelmed that I'm actually not being helpful to them. And so the question, what would be helpful to you? Like, if I have coaching for you, how do you want to receive it? How and when is an incredibly fruitful conversation to have.
Yeah, I was just going to ask, I mean, how do we go about navigating that, right? If someone is 3,000% more sensitive to something, right, but you don't know it, is it the onus on, you know, the person receiving the feedback to ultimately either develop better coping strategies or ways to adapt to that, or is it the person giving the feedback?
Yeah, whose fault is it? That's what we want to know.
Yeah.
Or whose responsibility is it? I've had people say, like, is there an app where I can figure out, like, exactly how sensitive everybody is? And, you know, I wish you could have like a Star Trek scanner to know. But the easy answer is just ask. I think that feedback isn't a meeting. Feedback is really a relationship. And so over time, talking about what are some of your pet peeves about feedback? And by the way, here's a couple things I'm sensitive about. And if I get triggered, here's how you'll be able to tell. And here's my advice to you when I am triggered, for helping me to hear what you're trying to tell me. Or like I can use humor to deflect when something is getting to me. So I've learned to say to the people I work pretty closely with, if you're giving me feedback and I make a joke, it can sound like I'm being very dismissive, but I'm making a joke because it's hitting pretty close to home. And I maybe just need a little bit of space to metabolize. And I promise you, I will circle back to you about it. So I just don't want you to misread that joking manner. But it's a little bit of a defense mechanism, maybe, to give me an out to have some time to process what I'm hearing and really trying to take on board. So those are the conversations that can really help us understand each other and work with our nature, as well as our nurture and habits, rather than against them.
And it seems like the best leaders, when it comes to feedback, like they want feedback. And I think this, a lot of this stems from those that want to make sure that there's no blind spots, right? There's not something that they're missing.
Yeah.
They reach out to people and say, what am I not seeing here? What am I not understanding about the situation? Because you could do the inverse of this, and I'd say those are the leaders that tend to struggle, right? That have it all figured out and know everything, and they just don't want to hear an alternative perspective. But I've heard you share actually a great example about a time, I think, where you were driving the car with your son when he was young, and it had to do with like red lights and green lights, if you'd be open to sharing that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So this is a son who actually is about to graduate from law school, just to let you know that he has followed down the primrose path in the same direction. So when he was about 3, one of the things that we sometimes say is that difficult conversations and feedback conversations are almost never about the facts. But every once in a while, I actually bump into something that I think, well, this is just an exception because here I know I'm right, right? And his feedback is wrong. Anyway, Ben was about 3 and we were driving down the street and we were stopped at a traffic light. And I said, hey, Ben, what color's the light? And he says, it's green. And I said, well, Ben, we're stopped at the light. What color's the light? He says, it's green. And as soon as it changes, he said, it's red. Let's go. I mean, the kids seemed pretty bright in most other ways, but I was just pretty sure that his answers and his feedback to me were wrong. Either that or I had gotten incredibly lucky in all these years I've been driving. And so, you know, my first hypothesis, I'm trying to figure this out, is that maybe he was colorblind. So I started testing him in other contexts to identify red and green. And in every other context, he got the answer right. And every time we came to a traffic light over the next few weeks, he would give me the opposite answer. My second hypothesis, by the way, was that he was messing with me,
yeah,
as you can imagine, which I did have some evidence for. It took 3 or 4 weeks, and then my mother-in-law happened to be in town. So she was in the front seat, and I happened to be in the back seat sitting next to him. And I suddenly realized that from where he sits in his car seat, he usually can't see the light in front of us. So he's looking out the side window, you know, because the headrest is in the way or it's over the top of the windshield. So he's sitting looking out the side window at the cross traffic light. And then I started imagining the conversation from his point of view, which is that he's looking at it. It's green. I'm insisting that it's red. He's just thinking, you know, my mom seems bright in most other ways, but she's just wrong about this. That story has stuck with me all these years because it's such a great example of the need for feedback for leaders, because it's so easy when you're in the front seat with the experience and the resources and the good view of the road and knowing where you're going, when someone pipes up in the back seat to say something that doesn't make any sense, it's so easy to dismiss it as just wrong and move on, when often it's the people in the back seat who see something coming, right? That's going to sideswipe you or are in closer contact with the folks on your staff, right? Who are feeling frustrated. And so your comment about blind spots is just so apt because whether we're driving or we're leading, we all have them and we actually need other people in order to see ourselves clearly and in order to see the whole picture together so that we can make the best decisions that we can.
Yeah. And Sheila, as we come to a close, this being the Game Changing Attorney podcast, what does being a game changer mean to you?
It probably means that I don't study how people do things. I try to study how people should do things, because the way we do them has gotten us where we are in some not great ways at the moment. So asking the question, what is the game that we're in and how do we change it, I think is the central question that we are wrestling with.
I want to give a huge thank you to Sheila Heen for taking the time to join us on the Game Changing Attorney podcast. If you found this episode valuable, here are 3 free ways that I can help you grow your law firm. Number 1, download the first chapter of my book absolutely free at gamechangingattorney.com. Number 2, you can shoot me a text at 404-531-7691 and I'll answer any question that you've got for me. And finally, number 3, if you can leave this podcast a 5-star review, it'll help us gain access to more influential thought leaders and bring their lessons learned here to you. For more information on our interview with Sheila Heen, see the show notes for this episode in your podcast app or visit legalpodcast.com.